I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. This hour, we'll be talking with the writer Jonathan Safran Foer about his new novel. It's called Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. Jonathan is here with me in the studio. And I thought before we got to the book, though, we'd start with some reflections on the death of one of America's, some say America's finest writer, Saul Bellow, as most of us have heard already, died yesterday. And Jonathan Safran Foer, I just can't imagine being a writer in America today and not having some kind of debt to what this man left behind him.
Well, particularly being a Jewish writer, actually. It was funny, you know, I was reading the New York Times obituary of Bellow this morning on the plane here from New York, and it was talking about his relationship with Judaism and how, you know, he didn't necessarily consider himself a Jewish writer, didn't want to be grouped together with Roth and yeah. Malamud, but the first book he wrote after winning the Nobel Prize was a nonfiction book about going to Jerusalem. And it's a really interesting model to live under. You know, you can't help but live under it as a young Jewish writer, in part because it's what you read.
But haven't I also seen you quoted in previous interviews as saying you'd rather not be known as a young Jewish writer, but as a young writer in America today?
It doesn't matter what you want to be known as. It's like the question, do you consider yourself a Jewish writer? I'm Jewish and I'm a writer. There's absolutely no way around it. Yeah. But, you know, speaking personally, and I think Bellow had a very similar experience, probably a much stronger experience in this way, it was the soil I was planted in. They were the kinds of stories I was being told when I was a kid. It was the kind of dinner table conversation we had. It had a real Jewish flavor. It was inflected with a kind of Yiddish, flair, a kind of Yiddish sense of humor, even the way the sentences were constructed. And I grew up reading Bellow. I grew up reading Roth. I grew up watching Woody Allen. And
Bellow was the son of Russian immigrants. You're the grandson of Ukrainian immigrants. Have I got that part right?
Actually, my mom was born in Poland.
Okay. Yeah. So, I mean, there's also that kind of attachment. That was part of what you wrote about in your first book, Everything is Illuminated.
Yeah. You don't realize how these things influence you until you start making things. At least that was my experience. You know, before I wrote my first book, if somebody had asked me, is Judaism something that weighs heavily on your mind or, you know, has any influence on your creative spirit, I would have said, no, it doesn't. I didn't go to synagogue. I didn't keep kosher. It wasn't something I identified with in any ways that I understood. But then I wrote my first book, and it was like a smoking gun. You know, I said, despite what I thought who I thought I was, the evidence clearly speaks otherwise.
We're going to bring in James Wood. He's listening in on the phone. James is a literary critic for The New Republic and long a fan of Saul Bellow. And in fact, the last time we talked about Saul Bellow on the program, James was here in the studio. James, good of you to join us.
Pleasure to be here.
I think on the program that we had before, you said something about Saul Bellow being the greatest modern American writer of prose. Does that sound accurate to you?
It sounds more than accurate to me, because I think it was a prose that did more of the things you want prose to do than any other that I ever found. It was lyrical, musical, but it could also be tough, witty, intellectual, and it was quite as beautiful as anything John Updike ever writes, but it was always grounded and never seemed to me to be subject to some of that preciousness that you find in very lyrical writers. But as Jonathan was suggesting, I think some of that music or that mingled music that you always felt in Bellow's prose had to do with the mingling of his influences. You know, he grew up speaking Yiddish at home, reading Hebrew until very late, until the last few weeks of his life. He could still recite from memory the opening verses of Genesis in Hebrew. Hearing and speaking French on the streets, because he was born in Quebec, and also, of course, developing this extraordinary relationship to English. So, in a way, the circumstances were absolutely propitious for this amazing prose.
He gave us also an introduction to characters in post-World War II writing, in American fiction writing, which seems to have kind of changed the rules a little bit. I'm thinking of Augie Marsh, for example.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I most like him about him as a novelist is that I think he has this broad view of the comic, which has much to do with his Russian roots. He always read Tolstoy and Dostoevsky with great attention, and you know, several of his novels, like The Victim and Seize the Day, seem to me highly influenced by the Russians. So there was always this this, I think you'd have to say, this broad view of what a comic character, a comic vessel in a novel could bear, and that's why most of his characters are sort of foaming with consciousness. He pours into them a great deal of ratiocination and intellectual thought and foolishness too. He may not be, you know, pound for pound the funniest laugh out loud writer. I think Roth in his riffs and rants is probably a funnier writer, but there's a broad, deep comedy there which I find beautifully appealing.
James, thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure.
James Wood, literary critic for The New Republic, long a fan of Saul Bellow, who died yesterday at age 89. Time now to turn to the new book we're talking about today. It's Jonathan Safran Foer's second novel. It's called Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. Now, the main narrator is a 9-year-old boy in New York called Oscar Schell. When Oscar comes home from school on September 11th, he finds 5 messages on the telephone answering machine. They are all from his father, who was having a meeting in the windows in the World Restaurant when the planes hit the towers. Oscar, so determined to protect his mother from the messages that he bundles the phone away for himself and borrows money from his father's drawer to buy another just like it. So the messages then become part of his own childlike attempt to unravel whatever it was that happened to his father in the final moments on that day. But it's not a true story. It's Foer's new novel, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close, and it's fiction. Young Oscar's detective work after 9/11 is wound in with his own family connections, going back to the Allied bombing of Dresden in 1945. So this hour, we turn our attention to Jonathan's novel. We'd like to have you join us. What are the risks and challenges of choosing as powerful and evocative a setting as 9/11 for a piece of fiction? Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Jonathan, what are the risks? Were there people saying, no, not yet, don't go near that subject matter if you're writing fiction?
Of course there are people who would say that. I would question why they would say that. You know, why are we so concerned with the territory of fiction when nobody, for example, asked if Tom Brokaw should be reporting on September 11th in the moments after? Forget about 4 years after. But, you know, he was live on television from Lower Manhattan. And there was a certain price to be paid in that, too. There were risks, as evidenced by how bad the coverage was in the first couple of weeks and months. It was overblown. It was alarmist. It was just factually incorrect. Kinds of reporting that I think a lot of journalists regretted after the fact. But it's okay, because we have to try. You know, you can't get it perfect right away. And we need to know what's going on, or we need to, you know, move in the direction of knowing what's going on. And so we allowed our journalists, whether the New York Times or NBC or radio, to piece things together while they went. With novelists, though, it seems there's a whole different set of concerns, as if certain territory doesn't belong to them in the way that it might belong to a journalist, or as if the story that's being told in a novel is less important than the story that's being told by journalists. And I just don't think that that's the case. When I think about, let's say, Saul Bellow, I trust his intellect as much as I trust any journalist, as much as I trust Tom Brokaw's. I trust his ethical sense as much as I trust any journalist's. I trust his knowing what he wants to say and the ability to say what he wants to say as much as I trust any journalist's. And the story that he would tell is every bit as indispensable. You know, journalists tend to traffic more in, I guess, the biographical realm. You know, this is the chronology of events. here are the major figures, here's how we could describe what happened. And novelists traffic in a kind of sympathetic language.
But you enter a territory with 9/11 where everybody, and I don't know anyone who doesn't have some kind of personal way of expressing what that day was, where they were, who they talked to, what it meant to them. And then so to enter that with a fictional story is, I mean, I can imagine some people saying that's like kryptonite for a fiction writer, that there's so much radioactive truth that's still around that story that to go in there with something made up is curious or daring or whatever you want to call it.
Well, isn't radioactive truth what we want to approach? You know, I think that the hesitancy is that this is such an important thing and it's such a sensitive thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's what we need fiction written about. We don't need fiction written about, you know, minor domestic disputes. We don't need fiction written about somebody, you know, a murder in an art museum necessarily as much as we need it about things like war, things like loss. And I think that artists should not run from that material but seek it out.
Connection listeners, do we need more fiction about the stories which, when they're true, are hard for us to face? Is that what good fiction does? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We'd like to have you join us this hour. Jonathan Safran Foer is my guest. We're talking about his new book, which is centered on 9/11. It's called Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection. The telephone number to join me this hour, 1-800-423-TALK. Jonathan Safran Foer is here. His debut novel, Everything is Illuminated, was named Book of the Year by the Los Angeles Times and the winner of many other prizes, too numerous to list here. We're talking about his second book. It's Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. That's the title, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. And Jonathan's here. We're talking about the subject of 9/11, which is at the center of this book. I wonder, in bringing fiction to something that has that kind of personal edge to it, if you know that the readers bring something different, or maybe they've got, you know, they're a little bit better dressed for this because they've already got something that they can bring to whatever you want to offer.
Yeah, it's like trying to whisper in a cathedral. The voice carries more than it does in, say, an elevator. You know, there's so many resonances, and I think it's something fiction always depends on is the idea that a reader is bringing something personalized to a book. So, and it's one of the things that's so wonderful, in fact, about fiction is that it's so constrained, you know, to language that if I use the word tree, I write T-R-E-E, four letters. When you read it, you conjure a certain image of a tree. When somebody else reads it, they conjure a different image, and that tree becomes your tree. And I don't think there's any other art form that belongs as much to the recipient than literature, you know. In part because the least information is actually conveyed, and it's the most evocative, I guess. But with this subject matter in particular, you're right. People come to it with very, very strong feelings, all sorts of experiences, memories, and you just can't cater to all of them. That's not the point. The point isn't to tell a definitive story. The point is to tell a story, to insert a voice into the mix. And a large part of the reason I wrote this book in the first place was because I felt there was a certain kind of story not being told. When September 11th was talked about, it was in a politicized way, almost exclusively, sometimes in a commercialized way, but never...
And sometimes in a very hushed, sort of respectful, unchallenging, unquestioning way at
right,
the same time.
Right. But very rarely in as a story of individuals. As an emotional story of a character living in the wake of the event.
Okay, I talked a little bit earlier in the program about, Oscar Schell, 9-year-old, son of Thomas Schell, who dies in the attacks on the towers. And you're going to read us a little something that tells us more about Oscar. Do we need to know anything further before you...
It's from page 2, so I hope not. So again, the narrator is this 9-year-old boy. I desperately wish I had my tambourine with me now because even after everything, I'm still wearing heavy boots, and sometimes it helps to play a good beat. My most impressive song that I can play on my tambourine is The Flight of the Bumblebee by Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, which is also the ringtone I downloaded for the cell phone I got after Dad died. It's pretty amazing that I can play The Flight of the Bumblebee because you have to hit incredibly fast in parts, and that's extremely hard for me because I don't really have wrists yet. Ron offered to buy me a 5-piece drum set. Well, money can't buy me love, obviously, but I asked if it would have Zildjian cymbals. He said, whatever you want, and then he took my yo-yo off my desk and started to walk the dog with it. I know he just wanted to be friendly, but it made me incredibly angry. Yo-yo moi, I told him, grabbing it back. What I really wanted to tell him was, you're not my dad, and you never will be. Isn't it so weird how the number of dead people is increasing, even though the earth stays the same size, so that one day there isn't going to be room to bury anyone anymore? One fascinating thing is that I read in National Geographic that there are more people alive now than have died in all of human history. In other words, if everyone wanted to play Hamlet at once, they couldn't, because there aren't enough skulls.
That's Jonathan Safran Foer reading from his new book, Extremely Loud. I never get that right. Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. I'm always afraid when I'm going to say it, I'm going to say Extremely Close and Incredibly Loud.
It's cumbersome.
That's okay.
So is my name.
It makes us work at it, I think, a little bit. The voice of this young character has a kind of rambly, rat-a-tat, almost ADD, jumping from subject to subject in the way that a mind works. Did you consciously work at that, or did you kind of let your own rambly mind go out on the page in the same way?
I very consciously worked at it. And, you know, frankly, that's the lesson I took from Saul Bellow's writing, is that, or the thing I most value in his writing, is energy. You know, the idea that each sentence can force you into the next sentence, can create more and more momentum. It can be a real snowball, you know, rolling down a hill. Joyce Carol Oates was a teacher of mine, and she once said to me that the most important quality any writer can ever have is energy. And I know that she meant it over the course of a career, mm-hmm. you know, something else that Saul Bellow very much lived out, being prolific, changing between books, trying different things, becoming bigger, becoming smaller, but also just on the sentence level. You know, how can you, what's the most force that you can put into each word?
It's interesting because when I was reading the book, I thought to myself, I must ask Jonathan whether or not the choice of a 9-year-old as a narrator is a limiting choice. But when you put it in terms of how you can express as much energy as possible in a sentence, it kind of turns around. You end up with someone who may be even more expressive.
I think choosing a 9-year-old as a reader would be very limiting. But having a 9-year-old character in a book isn't, because it's really the intelligence of the reader that the writer falls back on, not the intelligence of his characters. So, yes, of course, a 9-year-old is pre-sexual. It doesn't mean the reader is. So the reader can take all of, you know, his or her experience, all of his or her background, and apply it to the world of, in this case, Oscar, and say, here's a pre-sexual character. Here's a character who is missing these various things. Part of what's funny about Oscar, actually, to my mind, is the gap between his intelligence and the reader's intelligence. The things we know that he doesn't know. And more of the weight falls on the reader's shoulders than on the characters.
1-800-423-8255. That's the number to join our conversation this hour. Jonathan Safran Foer is here with me. We're going to go to Providence, Rhode Island for a call from Tina. Hi, Tina.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you fine. Go ahead.
Okay, hi. I'm just so thrilled to call in. I'm reading this book right now, and you were just talking about energy and force, and I literally feel propelled through the prose when I'm reading it. And I think, you know, when Jonathan Safran Foer was just talking about Tom Brokaw and journalists and their reporting of 9/11, it's funny because my experience in reading this novel so far, and I'm not done, is that it's truer than anything I've read about 9/11, even truer than, you know, minute-by-minute accounts of the actual facts of the events, because it's containing, I'm finding that reading about a child's experience of grief is just very deep, and it's the energy that he was talking about in terms of a 9-year-old, and the gap between what the reader knows and what a 9-year-old knows it somehow encapsulates the grief that much more.
To me, though, Tina, what I found interesting, and I'm going to let Jonathan in here in just a half a second, but is that Oscar, the 9-year-old, really doesn't express that grief except in, you know, references to having heavy boots on or wait. I mean, he doesn't really hit it head on. It's always just with him or over his shoulder. You know what I mean?
Yeah. But, you know, my experience, too, is that, I mean, even just my own experience as a child or having a child is that it almost rides alongside him like a shadow. And, you know, he talks about heavy boots and he has these cute expressions that, you know, supposedly depict the grief, but actually, I mean, he's just completely suffused with it, you know.
Mm-hmm. Or and pushing, I mean, it away at the same time, Jonathan. I don't know. I mean, it's a kind of a mix, isn't it?
To my mind, his inventions are the greatest expression of his grief. And, you know, the inventions take the form of these, like, very flamboyant, very imaginative, and often, like, pretty funny ideas that he comes up with.
Well, it's the absurdity that, in one sense, you know, adults pad their grief with all sorts of kind of, we have these preconceived notions of how we should be acting when we're in mourning or when we've seen something terrible or we're experiencing great pain. And, you know, even if you're really aware, you fall back on, you know, you should be weeping or you feel guilty if you're not. And you know, here he is, and, you know, his mind is reeling at all times. And it's the absurdity of his inventions that almost makes the poignancy that much more sharp, for me at least. But anyway, I also read an article about you in the, I think it was the New York Times Magazine, and, you know, you say there was a question that the journalist posed to you about time healing all wounds, and you asked the question, you know, what if time is the wound? And that actually has been on my mind a lot in general, but in my mind especially in reference to this book. And I'm not quite sure how, but somehow it seems relevant, so maybe I don't know if you have something to say about that.
It's hard. You know, I find it so hard to talk about my books in a way, because if I had another way to talk about them, that's what I would have written as the book. It's like the idea of trying to give a synopsis of a novel. You know, if I could have used fewer words to say what I wanted to say, I would have used those words. I really only tried to include things, you know, as efficiently as I could. And it's, for example, somebody asked me the other day, what exactly does heavy boots mean to begin with? You know, the person said, I have a kind of vague sense. It's like when Oscar's depressed or he's feeling weighted down or some sort of immobility. You know, he can't move, he can't move forward. But what does it mean to you? And I had to say, and I didn't mean to sound coy or evasive, that heavy boots just means heavy boots. That's why I used heavy boots. It's when writing a novel, I don't think that you, at least when I write novels, I am not referring to something else. It is always referring to itself. It's trying, you know, I'm really trying to create something organic that contains its own meaning. In terms of the idea of time being the wound, I think there's a notion, maybe it's an American notion, I'm not even sure, a kind of a Dr. Phil-like notion that things get better with time, that the wound goes away because everything is moving toward some kind of serenity. But it's not the case. And, you know, look, this book came out of the experience of time not healing the wound of September 11th for me. In fact, the more time passed, the more I thought about it, the more sad it made me. I think, like a lot of Americans, my first response was shock. And then there was a kind of anger, you know, very much guided by the government's reaction. Mm-hmm. And there wasn't really a place for grief in all of that. There's the surprise, sadness, our world is changing. 3,000 people have died, but it wasn't that, you know, grief is something that really does take time. And I couldn't have written this book immediately after September 11th, not because I would have thought it was the wrong thing to try to do, but because the wound hadn't opened up enough yet.
There are a couple of things about the book which people like Tina will know, but others who haven't seen it won't know, and that is that there are things that you do in the book which are a little bit unconventional. There are people who don't speak, and so they have the grandfather uses blank pages to scribble out notes. And when you present those to us, we get a sentence on a page. So here I am on page 19. And what I read on page 19 is, I want two rolls. I turn over to page 20 and it says, and I wouldn't say no to something sweet. Page 21, I'm sorry, this is the smallest I've got. 22, start spreading the news. 23, the regular pleas, and so on. Do you like the idea that you can take what is a pretty well-accepted form of words on the page and play with that a little bit?
You know, I don't know if that's if it was that idea that drew me toward the kinds of visuals that are in the book.
Yeah.
It was more that I was trying to think of the most forceful way to tell the story I wanted to tell. It's like, you know, if you liked to go to foreign countries and try foreign foods and learn foreign languages and buy foreign tchotchkes, you wouldn't describe yourself as a great passenger of airplanes. You just take airplanes to get to where you want to go. I think about novels like I think about airplanes. I don't have any particular reverence for the form. I do love how they take me to where I want to go. Because it's not the airplane that I'm in love with, I don't hesitate to alter it in any ways that might get me to where I want to go faster or might take me to someplace I want to go to even more. So if I could add a jet to an airplane or add another wing or flatten the nose, if I thought that that would get me to Australia in 6 hours rather than whatever it is, 24 hours, I would do it. When I was writing this book, I was thinking about that. I was thinking, what can I do to alter the form, not in the interest of altering the form, but in the interest of getting me to where I wanted to go faster. And there's several reasons why I think it makes sense with this specific book. One is the character of Oscar, and he has this flamboyant imagination, and he's really clinging to all of these inventions, in part so that he doesn't have to think about what's missing, and in part to try to fill in the mm-hmm. whole of what's missing. I wanted the book to be an invention. I wanted the form to echo the content. Also, specifically in reference to September 11th, it was the most visually documented event in human history. Nothing has ever been seen by so many people, and the experience of the day and the memory of the day, I think, takes the form of images. You can't think of September 11th without thinking of the image of the two buildings or the plane going into the buildings or the bodies falling from the buildings. And so in an effort to, you know, explore what happened in that day, I used the same tools actually that a journalist used. You know, what was it like? How can I show that? How can I try to express it?
My guest is Jonathan Safran Foer. We're talking about his new novel, Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. Just to take this one step further, if I can, Jonathan, the telephone messages that the father leaves on the home phone, which we get through the course of the book, are very powerful, in part because they remind us of the same sorts of things that we heard at the time. But I had a flash while I was reading one of them, and I wanted to ask you. I thought to myself, I bet if Jonathan could have put those in hypertext, like an internet page where I could click on them and hear the father, you probably would have done that in the way that you're sort of almost trying to pull apart the form of the novel to allow other ways in.
I wouldn't have. It's a very fine balance. It's like I was saying before with the word tree. The thing that novels depend on, really, really and truly, what makes them so wonderful is how little they give, not how much they give, but ways that they open themselves up to be personalized to each reader so that you hear it, you hear the voice. I couldn't make the voice that you would hear. And the voice that you hear when you read those messages is different than the voice anyone else hears. It's a voice that's probably inspired by your dad's voice or your grandfather's voice or a brother's voice, voices you've heard in your past of people that you've loved. Lord knows that when I was writing it, I was thinking of voices of people that I've, mm-hmm. you know, loved. And that's the emotional well that you drop the bucket into.
So you can stretch it, but you don't want to stretch it too far. You can fill a page with red circles or have another page where the text is so overlaid that you can't even read it, or include photographs, but there's a line.
It's a balance. Every novel is a balancing act of giving and withholding. And this novel actually didn't go farther in one direction than, you know, any other novel out there that doesn't include images. I just struck the balance in my own way.
1-800-423-8255 is the number to join my conversation this hour with Jonathan Safran Foer. What are the risks and the challenges of using 9/11 for a piece of fiction? And do you think that humor or fiction gives us a different way of understanding or reflecting back on moments like that? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. The name of the book is Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. You're listening to The Connection. My guest is Jonathan Safran Foer. We are talking about this book, which centers on 9/11. 1-800-423-8255 is the number to join the conversation. Mark in Somerville, Massachusetts, has been patiently waiting on the phone. Mark, thanks for your time.
Oh, thank you. Jonathan, hello.
Hi.
I would first like to say I've read both your books, and I got Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close the day it came out and finished it in 2 days, and it's a wonderful novel, and the reason I think it is because it is radioactive truth, going back to what was spoken about before the previous break. And I think it's so important to realize that and to identify that, because there are so many things out there that are referred to as art that I don't perceive as art. I perceive as more as entertainment, because I believe the duty of art is sometimes to embrace and sometimes to repulse and sometimes to do both. And I think in some ways, and this is a compliment, your book does both excellently. And I just applaud you for, you know, running along with that kind of energy. And I'm a writer myself, and it's a struggle to kind of keep true to yourself when you see everything else that's getting recognized that isn't necessarily that way. My question is...
Just before you get to your question, Mark, what's the place of a novel to entertain, though? I mean, does it have to have a certain quotient of entertainment to keep you turning the page?
Well, I think if that quotient is conscious on the part of the writer, it's already a failed mechanism before it's begun. Because if the duty of the writer is self-perceived, is just simply to entertain or simply to do anything, I think that defeats the whole point of creativity. And creativity is supposed to be born out of something that's almost unnameable. And, you know, if we're going to set up guidelines for ourselves before we jump into any sense of creativity, I think we've already lost the battle before we started it.
I'm going to get to your question in half a sec, but I want to hear what Jonathan has to say about that observation of yours.
I think I agree, but I know a lot of people who wouldn't agree. You know, I feel like books do have to be entertaining, but I don't think that that should be...
the reason.
Yeah. There's more than enough entertaining television, and there's more than enough entertaining film. It's more than enough entertaining music. There's more than enough entertaining visual art. There's no burden to entertain. It's not necessary.
But is there a burden? Is there a duty to produce art? Mark used the term... the word duty, and the little shiver ran over my back, because I hate to think that you somehow felt obliged to do this for me.
No, not at all. I mean, I think every work of art begins as a personal... whenever I make something, it always begins as something deeply personal. I'm not doing it for anybody else. You know, there's no message I want to convey. There's no argument I want to make. I write to see... why I write. I write to see what it is I'm going to write. It's really a process of discovery. And I'm always surprised by what I come up with. That having been said, you know, it's true. If you want somebody to be along with you, and I clearly have made that decision, mm-hmm. You know, I chose to publish my books. And I actually formed my books around the idea of publishing them. I didn't include everything I wrote. I edited. I formed them. I fit them into something. It's no coincidence that my book is between 100 and 1,000 pages. You know, I wanted to have something that I could share with people. And when you decide that you want to share something with somebody, if you really do want to engage them, it has to hold their attention. It doesn't mean that has to be your first concern. It doesn't mean that that's something that has to be at the forefront of your mind when you're making what you make. But it's a truth that if the product doesn't have that, if what you come up with doesn't have that, you're not going to be able to engage someone in the kind of conversation you would want to.
What do you think, Mark?
Well, I first just want to clarify, I completely agree with what you've both been saying. And when I said the word duty, I mean more of duty to oneself at the beginning of the process.
Right.
And I'm, of course, completely aware that, you know, as the process continues on, I'm working on something myself. And, of course, you have to make decisions. You know, you're not going to write a 2,000-page book and try to publish it, because probably no one's going to read it.
What was your question, Mark?
My question is one of process. There are so many arcs in the book that kind of feed into one another. The morality play in Hamlet that Oscar goes through, and you know, the grandfather trying to use the keypad on the phone to communicate to his wife that he hasn't seen in so many years. And is that born out of improvisation, an outline, or a fusion of both, because it's a very organized novel, but there's a lot of playing in there, and I just was wondering where that comes from.
One of my favorite things any writer ever said was Joseph Brodsky said, "The rhyme is smarter than the poet." And I think what he meant was poets write in verse not only because it sounds pretty to rhyme love and dove, but because when you find yourself near the end of a line knowing that you have to come up with a word that rhymes with love, you're in a real position. And you're forced to move in a direction you wouldn't necessarily have chosen, in a direction that he would think and I would think is probably better than the one you would have chosen. That nobody's really capable of writing anything great on purpose. You have to write something by submitting to accidents, by submitting to coincidences, by trying to put yourself out there in the way of these things. And it's why you need to get on the subway every day or go on the street every day and let the accidents happen to you. But it's also why, when writing, I try to avoid as much as possible any sort of expectations I might have of myself, any sort of outline of where I want to go, because then I'm only writing. I start a day and I have Z in mind and I will end up at Z. It's much more interesting to start a day and think I could possibly end up at 12, you know, something in a completely different numerical set.
So the organization then comes after.
It comes in the process. The way I work tends to be overwriting. I just write way more than I could ever use. And then I start clipping it back and arranging it in different ways. And the most amazing things come out of the woodwork. You know, I clip one chapter because it feels a little long. I move it to a little bit later in the book because that feels like a nice moment for it. And then I realize that that chapter ends on a line that flows, like that rhymes just so strongly with the beginning of the next chapter in a way that I never would have intended. But it opens up to all sorts of meanings to me. I trust my subconscious more than I trust my self-consciousness.
Let's go to Acton, Massachusetts for our next call. Nola's on the line. Hi, Nola.
Hi. Well, my questions and comments are far less literary and much more mundane.
It's all right. I'm a reader just like you. Go ahead.
I haven't read your new book. I just finished hearing on tape your first one, and I enjoyed very much the fact that you had these different voices and several stories in parallel and then ultimately connecting it all together, and it sounds to some extent as if that's your style in the new book as well. Would you say that's true?
No, it is. It is true. It's not something that was deliberate. It's funny.
Well, and the fact that you have a young person, what I consider the primary voice in your first book is a teenager, and you have a 9-year-old, and so I think it's interesting that you're having these intergenerational voices there as well.
Yeah, no, there are a lot of resonances between the two books. Things that I didn't intend, but I'm not at all surprised by. You know, I had a set of concerns when I wrote the first book, and I kept a lot of those concerns. I wasn't able to grow out of them or resolve them, and I assume they're things that I'm always going to write about. Both books have so much to do with how hard it is to communicate, how hard it is to say what you mean when you want to say it. And it's funny, you know, I didn't have such a hard time moving into a second book from a first book. In large part because I didn't even really write my first book. I just kind of ended up with it somehow. It was a very intuitive process. And when I found myself holding a stack of 350 pages, I thought, I'm very surprised that I'm holding a stack of 350 pages. My second book was so much more deliberate, so willful.
Does that mean it was harder to write?
Oh, 100 times harder.
Does that mean the third book is going to be even harder?
I assume it will. I assume it will. I saw W.G. Zabald, I think it was his last reading, actually, in America anyway, and he said being a writer is like the opposite of being a doctor. If you're a doctor, the 10th time you remove an appendix is much easier than the first, and by the 100th time, it's pretty much rote. Being a writer, it gets harder and harder and harder, in part because you realize how much you're choosing against. When I wrote my first book, I thought I was creating something. I thought I was making a positive statement. When I wrote my second book, after the first sentence, I said, oh boy, I'm not writing in the third person, and I'm not writing from a woman's perspective, and I'm not writing something that takes place in the 17th century, and I'm not writing a poem. You know, you cross out so many things with each sentence, and the farther you get into the book, the more you cross out, the less is possible. And when you get to the last sentence, the only book you could have written is the book you just wrote. It's very, very painful, because this is not the only book that I wanted to write.
But I can also see it being profoundly depressing, right? If you've decided that you want to be a writer, you meet someone, you say, hi, I'm Jonathan, I'm a writer. You know, it's not like I've written a book and then I'm going to go into medicine. And you're thinking, how old are you now?
28.
You're planning on writing for a few more years, and you're thinking to yourself, is this just going to get uglier and uglier?
It is, but I value that sliver that you can do more and more and more. You know, if you are canceling out every possibility, an infinite number of possibilities except for one, well, that's that one thing that you did. And if you hadn't written the book, you would have canceled out infinity. You know, that if you take the smallest step forward toward expressing what it is you want to express, if it's 1/100 millionth of what you think is inside of you, that 1/100 millionth is pretty good. You know, and at least so far, it seems worth all of the various insecurities that come along with it, all of the vulnerabilities, and all of the difficulties.
Let's go back to our phone lines. 1-800-423-8255, Cambridge, Massachusetts. Sam's on the line. Hi, Sam.
Hi. I hope not to be redundant with this question, but I didn't read the second book. I hope to get to it. I read Everything is Illuminated, and it was probably the best fiction of last year. I just loved it. They both deal with a grief. One is kind of a grief in time, if I will, the pogroms and the whole story of East European Jewry. And this one is an immediate kind of grief, a flash of grief that just happened. And I just wondered if you had anything to say about whether looking at one after the other informed, let him know anything about grief in general, or if there was any other connection between the two that he wants to talk about.
Well, you know, I think of them, they're obviously both very much about loss and about grief, but I also think of them both as being about joy, being very joyous books, books filled with not only humor, but a kind of celebration of life, life moving forward. I hope that both books end on notes that are not tragic, but at the very least ambiguous. You know, something is moving forward. And, you know, I write, in both cases, I didn't write the book that I wanted to write. I wrote the book that I wanted to read. In the case of the first book, it was so close to me, so close to my family's history, so close to my own experience. But I felt like the story wasn't being told in a way that I was living it. There are obviously wonderful, wonderful books, about World War II. Primo Levi is one of my favorite writers, but it doesn't mean he was telling my story. You know, I really was of a different generation, and I felt like there was a different way to approach the material, and it was something that would fill a hole in me, and that was why I wrote it. And as I said earlier, with this more recent tragedy, there was a very specific way that it was being talked about, and it wasn't the way that I was experiencing it. It was an event that I experienced a sadness. You know, once I got over those initial responses of fear or a kind of anger or a kind of confusion, it became sadness. And I didn't have something, there was nobody telling that story to me. There was no book that I could turn to, no film that I could see. And that was why I wanted to write what I wrote.
Your wife, Nicole Krauss, has a book coming out a little later this spring called The History of Love. I obviously haven't read it, but I did read an article that said, oh my God, this book has the same sort of mix of characters as Jonathan's book. And clearly they collaborated, worked together, read each other's stuff. And I thought I'd ask you about that. Is that part of the creative process for you?
No, in fact, we hadn't even met until we basically finished our books. I think, you know, it's like anything. People talk about what's easy to talk about. People say Oscar is like Holden Caulfield. Why? Because they're young. Because it's easy to talk about. People say Saul Bellow is like Philip Roth. Why? Because they're Jewish writers in America and it's easy to talk about. So, yeah, that's basically all I can say on that.
You know what it got me thinking about, though? Because you're 28 years old. You've written your first book got unbelievable reviews. Your second book is getting good reviews, some mixed reviews. And I'm thinking to myself, if I was 28 and I had poured as much of myself into a book, and somebody went, well, you know, it's not as good as his first book, but it's this and it's this, I'd disappear into some great pit of despair and wonder how I was ever going to get out of that. And I'm curious to know, I hope I'm not being too personal with this, but how do you deal with criticism and your determination to keep telling the stories that you want to tell?
I feel so much better with this book than I did with my last book. You know, I hope it goes without saying I wasn't writing for a reviewer. You know, I can't imagine a writer who did that and could achieve anything of any substance or meaning. When I wrote my first book, I sent it to 5 or 6 agents, all of whom rejected it. Then I found an agent who sent it to 5 or 6 publishers, all of whom rejected it. Then that agent fell ill. I had to find a new agent. I sent it to 3 agents, all of whom rejected it. Then I found an agent, and it went on to very wide critical success and commercial success. It was the exact same book that was getting rejected widely. Every word in the book was the same. Nothing was changed. So I learned a lesson early on that success in the world doesn't necessarily correspond to the success of a book. Great books are very often forgotten, and if you look at the bestseller list on any given week, you probably wouldn't want to write most of them. So the only thing you can fall back on is yourself, you know, your own sense of what's right, your own sense of what you want to say, your own sense of if you've said what you want
to
say.
Well, and your confidence in your ability to do that at the same time.
Yeah, which is very different from having confidence in writing something that will be recognized in a certain way. You just can't count on that. You know, people read for so many different reasons. There are people in the world who read looking for mistakes. There are people who read looking to love books. I don't want to have any of my sense of worth tied up in all of those contingencies.
You're a great writer, and this is a fun book to read. I thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Jonathan Safran Foer, author of Extremely Loud and Incredibly Close. A little earlier in the program, we heard a couple of words from James Wood, literary critic for The New Republic, when we were collectively bidding farewell to Saul Bellow, who died yesterday. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.